HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 71, recorded live Saturday, June 23rd, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Windows Home Server General Manager Charlie Kindle.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm sitting down here with Charlie Kindle, the General Manager of the Windows Home Server team. We've talked a little bit about Home Server before. I think I was able to mention that I was a beta tester, but it was all NDA there for a long time, so I wasn't able to talk a whole lot about Home Server. And rather than just me talking about my experience, now that we can speak about what we're experiencing in Home Server, we actually want to sit down with Charlie and talk about the product, what's the developer story is, some of the different extensibility APIs, and what the plan is for the future. Thanks, Charlie, for sitting down.
I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Now, this was originally called, was it Project X or something?
No, it was actually originally when it was an incubation project, the code name was Quattro.
Quattro.
And then as we became a product group within Microsoft, we renamed the code name for the product was Q, the letter Q.
Q. That I knew it was a letter, a single letter. Project Q. And I remember that people were putting on their messenger nicknames that they were running Project Q, and it was starting a lot of buzz around people. This was a beta that a lot of people wanted to be on.
Yeah.
Now, when I got on it, I actually took an old Media Center PC that I wasn't using and turned it into a Windows Home Server, found every external hard drive that I could find in my house and plugged them all in. And that's the thing that I think that people notice the first when they plug in a Home Server is that it turns everything into a big chunk of storage.
Yeah, so I'm curious, how many hard drives did you end up with?
I think I ended up with 6, varying in sizes from 20 gigs up to 500.
Yeah, we had one machine that we named Fred that had 23 drives attached to it at one point, just as a kind of a stress test. Yeah, so Drive Extender, the technology that enables, you know, what we were just talking about, is pretty cool, and we're pretty proud of it. It gives you this virtualized storage pool, the idea that you have, you know, you can just add drives and you have a single namespace for all of your files and folders. And on top of that, it provides redundancy with duplication so that if you have a failure, you don't have a hard drive, you don't lose any data. And it gives you the benefits that we've seen from RAID and RAID technologies in the past with a fraction of the complexity and far more flexibility.
So forgive my ignorance, as I only know what I've learned about RAID as a user and as someone who's read about it. But what is it that complicated? What is so? I mean, from everyone I've talked to about Drive Extender, it is really a pretty amazing piece of software, and it really is that it's a software solution. How is it different from a software RAID solution?
Well, first I'll start off by saying, you know, this product is built for consumers, and it's in their primary target are consumers who are not technical and they're not geeks.
Right.
And when we go talk to these customers, and we early on we asked them about RAID, and you know, this was mostly in the U.S. And of course their initial reaction is, well, isn't that something that kills bugs that you kill cockroaches with?
Right. The brand recognition.
Because they have no idea what RAID is, a normal consumer who uses a PC would never see such horrific technology. And RAID really was designed to solve a problem in the corporate computing space. It was never designed as a consumer technology.
Hmm.
The different RAID levels have been designed over the years, but it's a fairly old technology. And it turns out to be very fragile. It's fragile from a perspective of when you do have a failure, what that failure looks like.
Right.
So for example, if you, have a RAID 1 system and you have mirroring between two drives, if you want to replace one of the drive that fails, you have to replace it with a drive that's basically the same size.
Right. I remember doing RAID early on when I had a drive of one size and a smaller drive, and I ended up getting two smaller drives.
That's right. And then on top of that, it's usually restricted to a single bus type. So if you want to, have a RAID array, it's got to be all SATA drives or all IDE drives or all SCSI drives. And with Drive Extender, we allow you to use drives of any type and mix them together, and any size and mix them together.
Yeah, with my beta that I had, I ended up with a couple of external USB drives, two FireWire drives, two internal IDE drives, and I think I ended up with something like 800 gigs. It was some unusual number. It was like 864 gigs or something like that.
Right. We started the project back when it was still Quattro. We did some prototyping and had an early alpha that was actually based on using software RAID. You know, Windows includes a software RAID stack. And we actually used that, initially. And what we found was that it would be very difficult for us to deliver the end user experience we really wanted to provide, on top of RAID. And what we discovered is that we could apply our engineering resources and our IQ to designing something that actually met the requirements we had. And at the end of the day, it would actually be easier for us to accomplish that, given the expertise that we had, within Microsoft on this topic. So we're really excited about the idea that we can remove so many concepts from a consumer's, repertoire. So, you know, when you use Windows Home Server and you think about the storage aspects of it, all you know that you have is you have hard disks and you have shared folders.
Right.
And, it's really no more complicated than that. You add a new hard drive and your storage pool gets bigger, and you can have that storage pool is available to your shared folders.
Yeah. One of the things that really convinced me that this was something entirely different was the first time I opened the start menu, and there's only one thing in the start menu.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah, this is an appliance. I'm not supposed to be in here at all. That was pretty amazing.
That's right.
And then the way that you use remote desktop, one of the things that I like about this is that you install a little connector application on each of your machines in your home, basically registering each computer with the home server. And that single tray icon handles backup, handles health notifications, and lets you connect to the console. When you connect to the console, you're basically doing what appears to be a remote desktop connection into a single application. So you remote desktop over to this home server console. So whether you're logged in remotely or whether you're logged in locally, there is only one application you ever really need to care about on a home server. It's that main console.
Yeah, it allows us also, because we've built a solution the way you describe, where what we call the home server console, which is the tool that the homeowner is going to use to configure the server, to change settings relative to the server. That it's, you know, you think of it an analogy, it's like the web page you get when you buy a router and you go and configure a router or a wireless access point, right?
Right.
Well, that experience we decided to build, using on top of the remote desktop technology. And one of the advantages that it gives us is the ability for us to write native Windows code, for our administrative console. That whole console is written using C# and the .NET framework, and WinForms. And we were able to do, be able to use all those great Windows tools to do that, and not have to go to the lowest denominator of some sort of HTML representation, which is what most of these types of products do. And in addition to that, it made it really easy for us to enable a third party story, where third parties could build add-ins that added into our administration console, or the home server console, for their value add and for configuring their value add.
What kind of third-party things have you seen develop so far? I know I've been pressuring the guys at Mozy.com that do online backup to basically back up my home server.
Well, it's been interesting. You know, when you bring out a new product that has extensibility and platform capabilities, you never really know what you're going to get. You certainly can try and, you know, have some targeted efforts to try and get the people you believe should be on the platform to get there. What we've discovered is, that people are doing some pretty exciting stuff. There's a couple, a good list of add-ins that are available on the internet. There's a blog called wegotserve.co.uk, and he's got a nice list of the ones that are out there. But here's a couple examples. There's a company called, I think it's called Keep Vault, and they have an online backup service, an internet backup service that will back up your shared folders to their service, you know, on the internet. Mm-hmm. And they have a very nice add-in that, you know, presents a new tab in our admin console, allows you to configure that. There is an add-in for being able to upload your photos automatically to Flickr.
I saw
your
that
home
one.
Server will, it's called Sync. I think it's called Photo Sync.
That was very clever. I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, and another one that you know that is really good for the more enthusiast crowd is Wake on LAN. There's actually two of these where people have built add-ins that allow you to wake up your client computers from the home server console. And what that means is that you can connect into your house remotely via our remote access solution. And if your home computer is turned off, you can actually wake it up and turn it on remotely, so it's not doesn't have to be on all the time.
You know, that's a feature of the BIOS that has been out for years, but no one's really come up with a great way to do it.
Exactly.
And the remote access thing is a really quite extraordinary. The initial betas, I would go up and go to like dynamicdns.org, get myself a nice dynamic DNS name like Hanselman dot something, and then I would basically connect into my home server just by punching a hole in the firewall. I did my own port forwarding. And then I could look at the home server console, and then you would proxy remote desktop. And I thought that was the greatest thing ever, and I used it all over the place. It was a much better solution for me than using things like Hamachi or Go to My PC. And then I said, well, this is great. This is brilliant. And then the release candidate came out, and I noticed that you guys put up your own system. I think it was called LiveNode. That would give people like my mom or my dad who would not have the ability to, you know, bust holes in their firewall, much less come up with a dynamic DNS name. You'll use their Windows Live ID, sign them up for their own subdomain under something like livenode.com, and then they can get secure access to their machines. And then you used UPnP to talk to the router to bust the hole in the firewall yourself. I thought that was about the slickest user experience I'd seen in a long time.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those features that we'd planned for a long time, and knowing what I've knowing about home networks and the internet and, you know, my experience in building a lot of software, I knew that this would be really hard to get right. So I was always a little skeptical. But the team just delivered, and in conjunction with the Windows Live team, what we've delivered is this out of the box with Windows Home Server, you get a free name on the internet for your home. And it comes in the form right now in the beta in the RC. It's under the territory domain name of livenode.com. But when we RTM, that will switch over to homeserver.com.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
So just like you can sign up for a Hotmail address or any other address, you'll be able to sign up for whatever you want off of homeserver.com. So for example, you know, I would be able to get charliekindle.homeserver.com. And anywhere I am in the world, I'll be able to access my home server by using that URL. And as you said, we also, will automatically configure your router, if it supports UPnP to, open the appropriate ports and make that work.
So what's the security story there? Now that seems like a giant honeypot for evil people to run around at, you know, insert name here, .homeserver.com. How are you going to keep people from using passwords like password?
Yeah, well, one of the things we've done on the product is we have secure by default, and services are off by default. And so this whole remote access capability is off by default and has to be explicitly enabled. And if a user does choose to enable it, we then enforce complex passwords. And we think that's very important that people get educated on using complex passwords for things where there's a potential for people to do brute force attacks, as well as actually us going the next step of making it so that it's a requirement that they do so.
Now, one of the things that I've personally had a little trouble with is I recently switched from Comcast to Fios and or Fios, Verizon, and they won't let me run anything over port 80. So in the last few weeks, as I've upgraded to the latest version of Home Server and simultaneously got this new Verizon or any ISP that blocks port 80, I've become really neutered in my ability to use this thing. What kind of alternate port abilities will we have either in this version or a future version?
Well, fortunately, in the first version of the product, the secure aspect of our remote access runs over the SSL port, which is port 443.
Okay.
And port 80 is actually not necessary. If it's blocked, the product will still work. You just can't go to the unprotected homepage. You have to use an HTTPS URL. And so, for the situations where the ISPs are blocking port 80, it works fine. And the other part of this is it turns out that from a worldwide basis, the number of ISPs that are blocking port 80 is actually relatively small. Although that could change, or it could change for the better. We think that our product demonstrates that there's a demand for this type of thing and that, the ISPs, may choose to change the way they think about this. In the future, we will continue to improve the solution. And there's techniques that you can use for doing, port redirection and so forth, when you do have a DNS name. So we will be looking into those things.
So as an advanced user myself, if they block 443, I could certainly figure out ways to do port forwarding and still possibly, use the solution in a situation like this. I recognize that a lot of ISPs aren't blocking 80. It's just that Fios is becoming so popular with their high bandwidth solution. It's going to be a challenge to convince people that opening up port 80 for home server doesn't necessarily open up people for running their own web servers, behind the firewall.
Right. And again, with the first version of the product, and if you have the RC right now, if you're on a service that is blocking port 80, the product actually works just fine.
Yeah.
The only problem you have is that during our test where we're testing your internet connection, our dialog box will come back and say, "Hey, I can't see your home server from the internet." But the subsequent tests pass. What that means is that as long as you access your home server with the HTTPS URL, it will work fine.
So what's the security story then as far as, am I issuing myself my own SSL certificate, or does homeserver.com have a wildcard cert?
No, the home server itself is generating a self-signed cert in the RC, and it will do so also in RTM. The downside of this solution, and we recognize that there's an issue here, is when users go to access that page, they will be asked to, effectively ignore a warning about the validity of that certificate, because it is self-signed, and most internet browsers don't trust self-signed certificates.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't announced anything here yet, but we are working on a solution to this problem that will be made available in the very near future. And I don't want to talk any more about it,
sure,
we haven't announced any details. But we recognize that this is an issue, and it's something that we've been working on for a long time, and we've got, I think, a very creative solution that's in the works.
Okay. Well, I solved the solution by simply explicitly trusting it, and then everything was great.
Yeah, and for PCs that are that have been joined to the Windows Home Server using the connector software,
right,
if you were to take them on the road, we automatically install our cert on those client PCs, so they automatically trust their own home server. So it's really only when you're in an internet cafe or using someone else's PC.
Now, back to the drive extender thing, one of the things that really struck me when I went and backed up all the machines in my house, when I did it's a complete image backup, right?
Correct.
The amount of space that was used up seemed unbelievably small on the home server. I mean, I was backing up what I thought was hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes.
Right.
And it did not feel like, it also went so fast, it didn't feel possible. What am I missing?
Well, this is another one of those places where I get to say I'm extremely proud of my team, because we've done some, you know, very innovative stuff. There's really four places where we have some deep innovation we're proud of. This is one of them. We talked about Drive Extender, we talked about remote access, and this is the third one, which is the full computer PC backup. What happens, you know, we recognized very early on one of the core value propositions we had to deliver against was protecting people's data. And we thought about this from the perspective of, you know, we need to protect the people who accidentally delete a file and want to get that file back. That's the thick-fingered delete scenario. We thought about protecting people who have a client PC that goes wrong and they want to get that client PC back because, not necessarily because it has precious data on it, but because getting it back to the way it was yesterday normally is going to take days and days of reinstalling and reconfiguring. So it's really protecting time. And then the third scenario is the, you know, oh, my house is burned down or something catastrophic has happened. And, you know, fortunately everyone is safe. And fortunately all my precious data was backed up somewhere else. Those are the three areas that we want to protect against. And it turns out in the first version, the third one we did not have the time to address. We will address it in the future. The other two we think we've nailed, and we think the second one I talked about we've really nailed, which is the whole computer backup. And here's how it works. We take each PC in your house and we scan all the hard drives on that PC, and we take the clusters they're generally 4 kilobyte clusters. We take those clusters and we back them up to the server. But we do it in a way where we only transfer clusters to the server that have never been seen by the server before. This is called single instance storage.
So every cluster is tagged somehow uniquely.
Yes, that it's actually using a hashing algorithm.
Okay.
That's a very standard way of, you know, taking a block of data and saying it's unique or not.
Okay.
And so effectively on the home server is this database of clusters along with all the metadata that would be required to take all those clusters and turn them back into the original file system at a point in time. And so what this means is that you have this great savings in both how much data is transferred over the network, but also how much is actually stored on the server. And so like you, a lot of people who run Windows Home Server with multiple PCs backing it up, if you were to sum up all the used space on your 4 or 5 PCs, it may be 200 or 300 gigabytes of data. But if you were to look at the actual amount of data we're storing on the server, it's in the 50 or 60 gigabytes.
Right, right. It's creepy, frankly.
It is creepy. It is very creepy. But there's a famous quote about the only difference between magic and technology is something to do with no. What was
any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
There you go. That was Robert A. Heinlein, I believe.
Yeah, it's exactly what it feels like. Though the backups are ridiculously fast, and there's a certain sense. And I don't know if maybe you could solve it in a UI way, but there's a certain sense that nothing really happened, and am I really protected?
Yeah.
It's interesting, but it's also nice because it freed up space for things like, you know, my MP3s and my videos. So when I was thinking, wow, I don't think 700 gigs is going to be enough, it's turned out to be more than enough.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. You mentioned something that I think is fascinating is the UI challenges, the user experience challenges around this. And it is a challenge. And we spent a lot of time, with multiple designs on how to present this. And I'm not convinced we've completely gotten it right. Because as you mentioned, it still doesn't necessarily, present the complete confidence. But one of the nice things about getting the product out there is we'll be able to, you know, hear from actual customers who pay for it, which is a great way of being able to iterate.
Now, every once in a while, my home server will announce that it's balancing storage. What is that?
That is part of Drive Extender. And what it's doing there is it is making sure that one, if you have a shared folder that is marked for duplication, it is actually duplicated the data is all redundantly stored. And two, it is making sure that we are using your disks that you have on the most effective way possible.
Okay. So if I yanked a drive and I was protected because of duplication, at some point, either at the point that I yanked it or soon after, a rebalancing would occur and a redistribution of the bytes to make sure they were effectively duplicated again.
That is correct. The actual steps that would happen in that case is if a drive failed or you literally just yanked it out without telling us about it, your storage status would go from green to red, indicating you have a health problem on your home server. And then any shared folder that had files that was duplicated onto that drive would go from green, healthy, to yellow, failing, which indicates that, hey, you know, your data's still here. I still got a copy of it. But if you were to lose another drive, that would be bad. That's what failing means. And then if you said, okay, yeah, that drive is actually gone, it's dead, and you told us to remove it via the remove command, we would then go about making sure that your data was reduplicated across the other drives you still had, or the new drive you potentially have added to replace the one that was bad.
Now, a number of people have commented to me that they were surprised how little hardware they needed to run home server, and there's been a lot of confusion in the blogs about whether or not home server would be available to the moderate to advanced user, or if it was going to be exclusively an OEM hardware agreement. What's the story there?
Well, I'll address the question about the hardware requirements first. You know, remember, Windows Home Server is based on the Windows Server 2003 code base, which is, you know, derived from the Windows 2000 code base. And, you know, if you go back to when Windows Server 2003 was released, which was, I believe, in late 2002, and you think about the high-end server hardware that was available that time, it was 900 megahertz Pentium 3 processors. And the most advanced workloads on the planet were running on that hardware at that point in time. SQL Server, IS, Exchange, and so forth. And so the actual resource requirements for a Windows Server 2003 server are pretty meager.
Well, and it's very tightened. I mean, there's virtually nothing running on it. You've hardened it,
that's
clearly.
Right. So our resource requirements are also meager because of that. So that addresses the fact that it only requires effectively a 1 gigahertz Pentium 3 equivalent processor and half a gigabyte of memory. The question about, you know, how people will be able to buy the product, it's pretty straightforward. The primary way that the product will be sold is, through standard retail channels where consumers will buy a product built by an OEM, you know, Hewlett Packard, Medion, LaCie, the other ones that have announced, that they're going to be building Windows Home Servers. You'll be able to walk into your favorite electronics store, you know, Best Buy, whatever, and buy a box, bring it home, plug it in, and off you go. That's the primary way. But, you know, I helped build Windows Media Center Edition. And when we shipped Windows Media Center Edition, we realized that we had, a core part of our audience, our customer base, some would argue the most important part, which is the enthusiasts, really kind of like to build their own hardware. They like to go and buy, you know, components from Fry's or Newegg.com or whatever and piece the machine together the way they want and then install the software on it. And when we did Media Center Edition, we didn't make it available in a way that enthusiasts could do that. There were good reasons for that at the time. The hardware for tuner cards and so forth was really flaky at that time, and it was so there were good reasons for that. But it was a lesson learned, and so when we started this project, we applied that learning, and we said from the beginning that we would make the software available in a way that enthusiasts could build their own hardware.
Awesome.
And we are doing that. And we're doing that through the System Builder channel, which enables people to buy hardware from a system builder, the hardware that they want, and then install the software themselves. So we think by doing that, we get a focus on our primary market again, which is the end users that just want to buy a device, and as well satisfy the enthusiast base.
So it sounds like it will be challenging just to get the software if I want to repurpose an existing machine.
It's not really. I mean, it's just like today, if you wanted to go buy Windows Media Center Edition, it's possible. You know, you can find it in
OEM channels.
That's right. Just go to any of the system builders that are available online, for example.
Excellent, excellent. And do you see this as competing with something like a Drobo or any of these other kinds of single-purpose backup systems, or do you think it's because of the addition of the remote access and the shared users and all that kind of stuff? It appears to be more than just a backup robot. It's so much more. But do you think that people will compare it to those kinds of appliances?
Well, it's hard for me to say what people will do in terms of comparing things. My personal belief is that we are building a product that is very unique, and it has, from a scenario perspective of what the value it delivers to the customer, nothing comes close. And, you know, it ranges from the fact that we provide centralized storage for all of your PCs. We provide a comprehensive data protection system that isn't some app you install on a client PC and configure and then have to manually do stuff. The product does it for you. It provides the rich remote access capability that allows you to access your PCs and your files remotely. And then on top of that, it is a platform, right? We've already seen evidence of the third party add-ons that are coming online. There's already, more than several dozen, in the works that we're aware of.
Definitely attest that the developer SDK is very cool, and creating, yeah. you know, editing the manifest files and creating your own extensions onto the UI are really right. Very, very easy.
Yeah, I think all of that combines to a product that is very unique, and I don't think there's anything out there that you can compare it to. I think that you could take any one of our solutions, and you may be able to find a product in the market that tries to deliver that particular part of the solution, but nothing that does it in such an integrated way.
Great. I'm going to put up on the website links to the Home Server SDK, the Home Server site, some of your Channel 9 videos in the past. I've talked about this when it first came out, and I was allowed to talk after the NDA was lifted, but I'm totally excited about this. I got a little trouble for it, but I made the statement that I was more excited about Home Server than I was about Vista. And frankly, I'm kind of still there. I mean, it's changed the amount of, I call it psychic weight. You carry around a certain amount of psychic weight if your stuff's not backed up. And knowing that your entire house was backed up, there's a certain amount of lightness of being that occurs when everything you have is backed up. And I'm really excited about Home Server, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, I'm gratified to hear you say that, because I think that, you know, that was one of our goals going in. And I also appreciate you taking the time. This is a good conversation, and I really enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Well, thanks. This has been Scott Hanselman with Charlie Kindle, and this was another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.